The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from oprahmag.com. All right, this first article is from the entertainment section, and it's called Who Was Margaret Thatcher's Husband Dennis? The pair were married for over 50 years. Former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher is well known across the global stage, but the accomplishments of her private husband, Dennis Thatcher, are far less discussed. The pair married in 1951 and stayed together for over 50 years, including during her time as the leader of England from 1979 to 1990. I could never have been Prime Minister for more than 11 years without Dennis by my side. He was a fund of shrewd advice and penetrating comment, Margaret Thatcher wrote in her autobiography, and he very sensibly saved these for me rather than the outside world. Dennis died in 2003 and was remembered for his wit, his reluctance to speak with the press, and his motto as the partner of the most powerful politician in England, which was to always be present, never there. Interested parties will now get a closer glimpse, albeit a partially fictionalized one, into the lives of Dennis and Margaret Thatcher in season 4 of The Crown. To help prime you with more information about this under-the-radar figure, here's what you should know about Dennis Thatcher. Thatcher grew up wealthy, earned several military honors, and worked in the chemical industry. Born in Lewisham, London, in 1915, Thatcher first served in the Army during World War II, rising to the rank of Major in 1946 before being demobilized. During his tenure, he was praised for his tactical and organizational skills, including planning large troop movements. After leaving the military, Thatcher became a successful chemical executive, running his family's profitable company, Atlas, and eventually selling it in 1965. After selling Atlas to Castrol, it was eventually taken over by Burma Oil, which he worked for as part of the parent company board. Dennis's obituary in The Guardian notes that when Margaret Thatcher became leader of the Conservative opposition in 1975, and the media besieged the family home in Flood Street, Chelsea, her husband was at his desk at Burma Oil before 9 the next morning, as if nothing had happened. He continued working until later that year, retiring as the divisional director of Burma Oil. By that point, he became more involved as his wife's consort. Per The Guardian, he was once asked what his wife did for work by a stranger, and he replied, "She has a temporary job." Dennis Thatcher was married twice in his life, and both times just so happened to be to two women named Margaret. He met Margaret Kempson in 1941, and the pair married the following year. At the time, he was serving in the military, and so the two spent little time together, which ultimately led to a divorce in 1948, according to The Guardian. He then met Margaret Roberts in 1950 at an event for the Conservative Party, and the pair married in 1951, staying together until his death in June 2003. Still, it clearly took some wooing on Dennis's part, as Margaret Thatcher once said that her courtship was definitely not love at first sight, per The Telegraph. Dennis Thatcher shied away from the spotlight, and according to the New York Times, rarely gave interviews. He was known for self-effacing humor and speaking plainly and directly when he did choose to address reporters. Prior to his death, he did an interview with his daughter Carol, where he shared some thoughts on how to handle situations around the media. "Don't give them a chance to either make fun or be rude," he said, "and certainly don't get caught by the press having too much to drink. You had to be a bit cunning." According to the BBC, he even may have referred to journalists as reptiles. Part of his ire likely came from the fact that he was parodied in publications like the satirical magazine Private Eye. When the BBC ran a gag radio story about his wife legalizing hard drugs, Dennis wrote to the outlet, describing the broadcast as a disgrace by any standard, however low. Away from the public eye, Dennis Thatcher had his share of struggles, including a reported nervous breakdown in 1964 that, per the Telegraph, may have led him to consider a divorce from Margaret. Both Thatchers were members of the Conservative Party, otherwise known as the Tories, and Dennis even ran once for office as part of the Kent County Council, albeit unsuccessfully. Dennis broadly seemed to support his wife's policies, never contradicting her in public, and little behind-the-scenes reporting indicates that they were at odds ideologically. The couple were targeted by the Irish Republican Army in 1984 as the radical group planted a bomb in the hotel where they were staying. The Thatchers were unharmed, though 5 people were killed, and another 30 sustained injuries as a result of the explosion. The Prime Minister came down hard against the IRA, prompted by that experience, as well as the assassination of Lord Louis Mountbatten. But there was one notable political issue which the famously aligned couple seemed to differ on. Documents indicate that Margaret Thatcher supported the reinstitution of the death penalty, a view that was not shared by Dennis, who went so far as to call the practice barbaric, according to the Telegraph. As her political career wound down, Dennis advocated for Margaret to resign, saying that she had done enough. She did so in 1990, after a leadership challenge within the Conservative Party left her with a lack of support. According to The Guardian, Dennis predicted the backlash against Margaret back in 1987, following her last election win. "In a year, she'll be so unpopular, you won't believe it," he said. Mark and Carol, the 2 Thatcher children, came into the world in dramatic fashion. Born prematurely in 1953, according to Chris Ongen's Maggie, their parents' success, high-stake careers, and notoriety meant that the family was not especially close, and both children were sent off to boarding school young. "Family rushed past us, eclipsed by the sheer pace of my mother's career, as she worked her way up the greasy political pole," Carol reportedly said, per The Guardian. "And my father's as well, when he was running his own family business. We never had long, relaxed, talking Sunday lunches." Mark is known for being part of the amateur car racing world, and in 1980 he participated in Le Mans, one of the most storied and prestigious races in the world. He is also known for disappearing for several days along with 2 racing teammates in the Sahara Desert in 1982, per the BBC. This event is covered in season 4 of The Crown. Mark was participating in the Dakar Rally, then known as the Paris-Dakar Rally, another prestigious race, when his car broke down. He was eventually found by the Algerian military. Carol Thatcher carved out a career as a writer and media figure, penning books about both her father, below the parapet, and her mother, a swim-on part in the goldfish bowl. The Guardian noted that Mark was the one closer with Margaret, while Carol was referred to as very much the twin less favored by her mother. On June 26, 2003, Dennis Thatcher passed away in a London hospital with his wife and 2 children by his side, per the New York Times. The paper reported that he had been having health struggles for several months following a heart bypass procedure, and he was 88 years old. Obituaries focused on his shying away from the spotlight, his quick wit, and the history of his relationship with Margaret. She lived until April 8, 2013, but never remarried. Much has been made of Gillian Anderson's portrayal of Margaret Thatcher on this season of The Crown, which is the first time the former Prime Minister will be depicted on the show. Season 4 will also be the first time we see Dennis, who will be played by veteran British character actor Stephen Boxer. Boxer is best known from his role in the British medical soap opera Doctors, as well as detective procedurals like Prime Suspect. Dennis Thatcher has previously been portrayed by Rory Kinnear in The Long Walk to Finchley, Jim Broadbent in The Iron Lady, and Ian McDiarmid in Margaret. Okay, this next article is called The Principles and Meaning of Kwanzaa. The holiday is a call to celebrate the richness of what it means to be African American. Kwanzaa, which is observed from December 26 through January 1st, is a 7-day celebration of African roots, observed by people of all faith backgrounds, since it's not tied to any religion. Instead, the African American holiday is anchored by 7 principles, known as Nuso Saba. Kwanzaa offers a new dialogue on Black culture about our positive contributions to the world and not just the negative stigma of race, said Dr. Adam Clark, an associate professor of theology at Xavier University. The word Kwanzaa comes from the Swahili phrase Matunda ya Kwanzaa, or first fruits, referring to the agricultural harvest festivals that are found throughout Africa, according to Kelly Navies, specialist of oral histories for the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Born out of the Black Power movement of the 1960s and founded in 1966 in the United States by activist and educator Dr. Maulana Karenga, Kwanzaa was formed as a way to empower people to rediscover their African heritage and concretize the expression of the Nuso Saba. This is a value system organized by 7 key principles. The beauty of Kwanzaa is it doesn't start Black history from slavery, explains Clark, who was also the founder and co-editor of Columbia University's Black Theology Papers Project. It actually starts us as inventors of civilizations, people who first broke from the animal world, spoke the first human truths, wrote the first basic text of human knowledge, and so on, he says. That's what Kwanzaa does. It gives us a long memory, a long cultural biography. The concepts and symbols of Kwanzaa derive from traditions and practices found throughout Africa and the African diaspora, says Navies. She adds that the language used is Kiswahili, the common tongue of the Great Lakes region of East Africa, and one of the most widely spoken languages in Africa. The primary symbols of Kwanzaa are the 7 candles, Mishuma Saba, which represent the 7 principles, the candle holder, Kinara, Unity Cup, Kikombe Cha Umoja, Placemat, Meka, Crops, Mazao, Corn, Muhindi, and Gifts, Zawadi. All items are displayed on the Meka. This serves as a reminder of how African heritage is built upon tradition. The Kwanzaa candle colors are black, red, and green. A key custom during Kwanzaa is the daily lighting of the kinara. On day 1, the black candle, also known as the unity candle, is lit. On the 2nd day, the red candle on the immediate right of the unity candle is burned. On day 3, the green candle on the immediate left side of the unity candle is lit, and then the candles continue to alternate until you reach day 7. Clark points out that black, red, and green are the colors of African American people, originally given by Marcus Garvey, civil rights activist and leader of the Pan-Africanism movement, which aimed to unite people of African descent globally. When observing Kwanzaa, the black candle symbolizes the people themselves. The 3 red candles are for the struggle or blood shed in the past, and the 3 green candles represent the earth or the abundance of possibilities the future holds. Each day of Kwanzaa highlights a specific principle. The 1st day of Kwanzaa honors umoja, or unity. That's when the goal of unity in the family, community, nation, and race is declared, says Navies. Self-determination marks day 2. The essence of this principle is the ability to define ourselves, name ourselves, create for ourselves, and speak for ourselves, she explains. Despite limited media portrayal of the Black experience, this principle summons a people to write their own narrative. Next comes Ujima, which reveres collective work and responsibility for the development and preservation of Black communities. It's also a lens to process the problems of others as your own and challenges the practitioner to seek to collectively solve problems affecting the Black community. Long before Beyoncé created her directory of Black-owned businesses, Ujamaa, or cooperative economics, urged Black communities to invest in themselves financially on the 4th day of Kwanzaa, by operating or supporting black establishments and creating ways to earn profits together. Nia means purpose and is the focus of day 5. The idea is to embolden the participant to make our collective vocation the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness, describes Navies. The 6th day's theme is Kumbha, which represents creativity. It also serves as a reminder to use the talents within to beautify and inspire the world at large, while understanding the importance of preserving the earth for generations to come. Finally, Kwanzaa is closed out with Imani, faith. No dogma or doctrine here, just a moment to believe with all our hearts in our people and the righteousness and victory of our struggle, says Navies. In The Black Candle, a 2008 documentary on Kwanzaa, narrated by the late Dr. Maya Angelou, she explains, "While the first principle of Umoja brings us closer and harnesses our strength, the last principle, Imani, inspires us and sustains our togetherness. Let us have faith in ourselves, in our Creator, in our mothers and fathers, in our grandmothers and grandfathers, in our elders and in our future. Knowing that we are more than keepers of our brothers and sisters, we are our brothers and sisters." All right, this next article is called Pharrell Williams' Secret to Aging in Reverse is his new skincare line, Human Race. Botox is not part of the equation. We'll just say it, Pharrell Williams is the Benjamin Button of the music industry. The 47-year-old singer, rapper, and producer looks almost more youthful now than he did when he first went solo with his first single in 2003. So, it was no surprise when we learned that Williams is now channeling his creative energy into a brand new skincare line called Human Race. What also comes as no surprise, the 3-piece collection, a cleanser, exfoliating product, and moisturizer, is about more than just looking after for yourself superficially. The line has firm roots in the ubiquitous but elusive idea of self-care. Used concurrently, the products provide the groundwork for a 3-minute daily facial and a brief respite from, well, life. "Self-care is essential not only to be healthy in body but healthy in mind," William tells me, and it's a philosophy that's clearly resonating. As of this writing, Human Race was sold out online. And if the stylish, refillable packaging isn't proof enough, this line is meant to be used by anyone. "We're more than gender neutral," says Williams. "We're for human beings, hence the name Human Race." He shares the skincare step he thinks that everyone should lean into, why wrinkles are essential, and what he wishes more men realized about their skin. "Is Human Race inspired by your own skincare regimen?" "Yes, it's based on a routine I've been committed to doing for the past 20 years. I worked hand in hand with my dermatologist, who determined that there are 3 necessary pillars in skin health: cleansing, exfoliating the dead layers of skin, and humidifying, which is locking in moisture. So what's the secret to youthful and healthy skin? The secret is leaning into exfoliation, locking in moisture, and staying committed to your skincare routine." How involved was your dermatologist, Dr. Elena Jones, in the development process? "I've been seeing Dr. Jones for over 20 years. She really taught me the value of taking care of my skin and having an effective routine. For Human Race, she helped with the formulations, making sure the ingredients were effective, that it was for all skin types, and that the routine could easily be followed in 3 steps. In addition to being sustainable, the packaging features Braille. Why was that important to include?" "We couldn't, in good conscience, call ourselves Human Race and not have Braille be part of the packaging." "Do you get cosmetic treatments like Botox, fillers, peels, or the like?" "No, I think wrinkles are essential. Wrinkles and such match the energy of your existence to your physicality. Your face is the result of the spirit behind it. We should be celebrating lines and wrinkles. Do you think phrases like black don't crack are harmful? This may sound controversial, but some stereotypes are true. The historical and racial overtones of them may just be politically motivated. When you look at the truth, melanated skin is inherently beautiful. How do you see men evolving in terms of their interest in skincare? It's been unfortunate because up until now, skincare has been marketed to men with gender biases. It's either been hypersexualized or it's marketed around basic hygiene that stops beyond soap and deodorant. The category should be for humans. Facial skincare should be a conversation anyone feels they can be part of. I'm seeing more men being interested in skincare, but they can't find a way into the category because of the stigmas. My relationship with Chanel began because there was women's clothing and accessories I felt I could wear. And so I did. Skincare should not be something you should determine if you can pull off. You should be focused on caring for your skin. It's your self-expression tool. What is your wish for the world in 2021? That more people are self-aware. That people see themselves. At the moment, our phones captivate us and distract us, and we don't really mean the things we say, do, feel, think, and intend. It affects far more people than we think, and not necessarily in the best ways. How do you live your best life? In gratitude. God is the greatest. He never misses. Okay, and now I'm going to read about some unique Christmas traditions to start with your family this year. All right. There's a reason the holiday season tends to evoke such warm and fuzzy feelings. It's one of the few times during the year when we can press pause on the hustle and bustle of the always-on world we live in. And those who celebrate gather with loved ones to partake in time Christmas traditions. Some people's must-do Christmas activities include watching Hallmark movies, whereas others bake family recipes and wintry desserts while playing festive tunes. But if you're seeking a new custom to add to your itinerary, there are countless ideas, both old and new, to adopt for the first time this year. Though many of the oldest Christmas traditions from around the world in countries like France, Germany, and England are still prevalent today, caroling and markets, for example, there's also an abundance of fun modern options, like doing a cookie swap with pals. And while the holidays may seem a little different in 2020, every tradition listed here can be made social distancing friendly. Whether you're looking for traditions to start with a baby, or just want to make the season feel extra special this year, here are some options for kids, couples, and chosen family of all kinds. No matter how you choose to celebrate, these little rituals add an element of intimacy that's part of what makes December 24th and December 25th and the weeks leading up to it magical for so many. These sweet and unique ideas are sure to leave you with fond memories. You can collect memento Christmas ornaments. One of the most touching ways to mark the passing years is to have a custom ornament made each holiday season. Whether you have moved or sent your first child to kindergarten, you'll be flooded with memories each time you pull that trinket out of storage to hang with care. You can play holiday-themed trivia. Put a festive spin on game night with a few rounds of Christmas trivia, like this list of holiday movie-themed questions. The winner gets bragging rights, or you can make it interesting with a prize. Extra milk and cookies, perhaps? Listen to a holiday story. Cozy up for some quality time as you listen to a Christmas-themed tale together while you craft, make cookies, or simply relax. Try the audio version of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, or, if a more modern option is your family's style, there's author David Sedaris' hilarious and true modern classic, Santaland Diaries, about his time as a Macy's elf. Pick out a tree. Whether you trek to a tree farm, run down to the street corner, or peruse a local nursery, there are plenty of ways to make the experience a memorable one. Participate in a toy drive. Adopting a child through a local nonprofit organization such as Toys for Tots is another way to incorporate a charitable component to the holiday. In most cases, they'll provide a small wish list, and then you do the shopping and you drop off wrapped presents at a predetermined location. Sip mulled wine. For an extra special holiday treat, whip up this popular European winter beverage. It's essentially a warm red wine flavored with spices like cinnamon and clove. Participate in a secret Santa. This tradition goes by several other names, including Pollyanna, and it's played by families and office coworkers alike. How does it work exactly? Participants select a name at random, usually out of a hat, and then they shop for a small present, typically under $20 or so, for that person. Sometimes offices may opt for a white elephant or a Yankee swap instead. The concept is similar, but in these cases, participants draw gifts out of a bag, trading prizes until the game concludes with a last pick. Host a cookie swap. Christmas cookies are a holiday staple, but there's only so much baking one person can do. Expand your horizons by hosting a neighborhood cookie swap. Each person bakes a few dozen cookies of a single variety, and then everyone gets together for an evening of festive merriment to split the haul. Make it extra safe in 2020 by planning virtually and doing a doorstep drop-off on the big day. Go caroling. According to stories behind the great traditions of Christmas, caroling is an ancient word that refers to dancing or singing songs of praise and happiness. In the Dark Ages, it was a year-round practice, but later fell out of favor since it was considered a pagan celebration. It wasn't until the early 16th century, when Martin Luther embraced caroling, that it became a common practice during the Christmas season. This is when the tunes we still sing today, like Silent Night, were first composed. If you're feeling inspired, don't just limit yourself to your immediate neighborhood. Turn up somewhere that could really use an extra dose of holiday cheer, like outside of a hospital, for example. But check whether they're welcoming outside carolers first. All right, this next article is called Growing Up in a Japanese Detainment Camp Turned This 90-Year-Old into a Black Lives Matter Activist. I'm fighting to keep injustice from happening again. I didn't speak English until I started kindergarten. I remember pulling the teacher's skirt when I wanted her to come look at something. My father was a Japanese immigrant. My mother was born in the U.S. but educated in Japan. In my early childhood, we moved around farms in Southern California, growing things like strawberries and tomatoes. In those days, Japanese people who were non-citizens, like my dad, weren't allowed to own land or lease farms for longer than 3 years. I was 11 when World War II broke out. Although at school I heard things like dirty Japs, those comments were directed toward the enemy army, not toward me personally. But right after Pearl Harbor, there were roundups of some older Japanese men. When the order for families to move to the camps was posted at the community schoolhouse, my parents destroyed all the Japanese goods in our home and burned our old letters and books. We took a train to the detainment camp at Poston, Arizona. It was so hot, 115 degrees. That first summer was just unbearable. And the camp was so raw, still being constructed. They'd bulldozed that desert island and plunked down flimsy barracks. It was just dust, dust, dust. And when it rained, mud, mud, mud. Each was divided into four rooms, five bodies to a room with a light bulb hanging from a cord, metal cots, and canvas bags you filled with straw for mattresses. Meals were announced by clanging gongs. We would all get in line and go into the mess hall. The latrines were in the middle of the blocks. We'd sometimes have to line up to use those, too. The family structure began to break down because you didn't have to eat with your parents in the mess halls. The kids at my age all sat together. A whole new social order was coming about. It took a while for school to get organized, so that first summer we had nothing but time on our hands. Boys formed gangs, and girls did, too, since we were freed from chores and out from under parental rule. When school finally started, they used empty bedrooms as classrooms, and it took a year before we had blackboards or enough chairs. There were no typewriters. The typing class practiced on circles they'd drawn on paper to create keys. There were two different groups of people in the camps. The Issei, the older generation who were not citizens, and the younger group. American-born and educated. Prisoners ran the camps under the supervision of the War Relocation Authority, but the government wouldn't allow the Issei to hold any positions of authority. You can imagine how the old folks felt. They had literally lost their life's work. And then to come into a camp and be stripped of any possibility of power. There was a tremendous internal conflict. Here are these older men saying things like, "If America's so great and you're American, why are you stuck here?" Eventually, my parents decided they didn't want to stay in the United States. They signed repatriation papers for my father to return to Japan, which meant the whole family would. I was 13 and very clear that I was American. I had a big fight with my folks. My father happened to be an easygoing, nice guy. But I observed a lot of men who were drunks running their families with an iron hand. In the camps, they became even more bitter and angry. I thought, who wants to live in a country where men have so much power? We never did go back to Japan. The war ended when I was 15, and we were able to leave the camp, settling on a goldfish farm where my father found work. A year later, my mother died suddenly of bleeding ulcers. And I went to do my last year of high school in L.A., where I worked for a family, doing the dishes and babysitting the kids. After my mother's death, we never spoke of the camps again. I attended Berkeley in the early 50s during the Red Scare, and I married a Caucasian. We were both lefties, active in the civil rights movement, anti-Vietnam, pro-feminism. Internment was something the Japanese community didn't want to talk about. But being involved with Black civil rights made me think about what had happened to us. I became active fighting, lobbying for Japanese Americans to be compensated for the time they spent in camps, and I was named a plaintiff in the class action suit seeking reparations. It went all the way to the Supreme Court before the case was declared moot. We had several parallel initiatives going on at the same time. And before the court case ended, Congress passed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, giving each surviving internee $20,000. I place our experience into the history of racism in this country, part of a continuum from the very beginning. What happened to us as kids is happening to migrant children right now. I'm very active in a group of Japanese Americans protesting the migrant detention centers and the way asylum seekers are being treated. I'm happy that I'm still healthy enough to stay engaged. My sister and I go to a particular street corner every Friday to do a vigil, and I hold this sign that says, "Yellow Power, for Black Lives Matter." I don't knit, and I don't crochet. I don't do crossword puzzles. I'm a political activist, and I always will be. Now I'm going to read an article called How Three Kings Day is Celebrated. The holiday is on January 6th. Three Kings Day, also known as Epiphany, is a celebration of the figures referred to as the Three Wise Men, the Magi, or the Three Kings, who traveled to pay homage to the recently born Jesus Christ, to hail him as a king in Bethlehem. It occurs on January 6th. The arrival of the Magi is written about in the Bible's Gospel of Matthew, which says that Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar traveled for 12 days to reach Jesus. They each brought a unique gift. The event is commemorated in the song We Three Kings, and the trio is often portrayed in Three Kings parades everywhere from New York City to Madrid to Uruguay. For an overview about Three Kings Day, including its history and how it's celebrated, we spoke to Miriam Ortiz, a catechist at the Church of Ascension in Manhattan. The Three Kings, who are also known as the Three Wise Men, first met with Herod, then governor of Judea, who told the trio to go to Bethlehem, according to El Museo de Barrio, which is known for its large Three Kings Day parade in New York. The museum also posited that based on where they were traveling from, it can be surmised that they came from either Asia or Africa, though there is variance in the way the story itself is told. The museum wrote that Melchior is typically depicted as being Arab or descending from northern Africa, while Caspar is sometimes portrayed as Asian. They note that Balthazar is often shown as Ethiopian. Three Kings Day celebrates the welcoming of Jesus, says Ortiz. These three wise men came together after the birth of Jesus was foretold. They had faith, and that's what's really important. The example of faith to travel miles because they actually believed. I think that's what the three kings signify: faith, hope, and charity. The arrival of the three kings has been depicted in many works of art, including Adoration of the Magi paintings by artists like Leonardo da Vinci, Sandro Botticelli, and Hieronymus Bosch, as well as many nativity scenes. According to Ortiz, some of the artistic depictions of the arrival of the three kings have led to misconceptions, including that Jesus was a newborn when they greeted him. Common lore is that they got there and Jesus was still a baby, but that's not really true. That's just for art's sake. We know that it took months for the three kings to travel. Jesus could have been any age between 1 and 2 years old, she explains, also noting that the Bible says they visited the house, not the stable. I think for artistic significance, they show a baby, but really, Jesus was much older. As noted by the New York Times, Three Kings Day is known as the Epiphany and celebrated in many cultures. In the Czech Republic, for example, there are parades, as well as a tradition where people plunge themselves into the freezing cold Vltava River to look for a wooden crucifix. Per that same piece, the tradition of diving into bodies of water is also common in Russia, Greece, and Bulgaria, as well as among the Greek Orthodox in Australia, where it is known as Blessing of the Waters. According to the museum, the Epiphany is celebrated by the Anglican, Eastern, and Roman Catholic churches. Per the BBC, many Orthodox sects of Christianity believe the Epiphany on January 19th. The January 6th date is celebrated by Catholics and within Vatican City through a Sunday Mass and a statement from the Pope. We need to arise, to get up from our sedentary lives and prepare for a journey, Pope Francis said during his 2019 address. We also need to shine, to be clothed in God who is light day by day until we are fully clothed in Jesus. In Spanish-speaking countries and areas, the day features large celebrations, from Spain to Puerto Rico to American cities like Miami and New York with significant Catholic Spanish-speaking populations, Three Kings Day is often honored. Madrid has a grand, vibrant parade on the evening of January 5th, for example. In Puerto Rico, Ortiz says the holiday is celebrated for an additional 8 days afterward. To commemorate the day, Three Kings bread is typically eaten. According to Velas magazine, Three Kings bread, also known as Rosca de Reyes, is an oval-shaped dish made of sweet dough and typically flavored with additions like orange extract, orange blossom water, crystallized fruits, jam, and sugar paste. Ortiz explains that the cake is also popular in Mexico and France under the name Galette de Roy, which, like Rosca de Reyes, translates to the Cake of the Kings. She says that in some communities, a tiny baby doll or some other small item is hidden within the cake. Traditionally, children leave treats for camels. Ortiz, whose parents come from Puerto Rico, shares some of the stories they told her about how they celebrated the holiday. Some of the ways of acknowledging the day are pretty close to Christmas, particularly with traditions related to Santa Claus. As children, my parents would place hay and water under the bed for the camels, so that when the three kings arrived, they could feed them. If they had a piece of bread or something they could leave for the three kings, they would do that. And in the morning, the water and the hay would be gone, and a toy would be left in their place. In a 2017 interview with the Washington Post, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who was a New Yorker of Puerto Rican descent, described Three Kings Day in his household growing up. He talked about gathering grass and hay for the camels and leaving it in a shoebox near his bed. Just like you would leave milk and cookies for Santa, we're leaving grass and hay for the camels to eat because they've obviously come a long way if they're coming to Upper Manhattan to bring you toys, he joked. According to NBC News, in countries like Uruguay, Mexico, and Spain, young kids leave their shoes out to be filled with gifts the night before the holiday. Three Kings Day is connected to Christmas. Three Kings Day and Christmas share not only a season, but other similarities too. The key difference is that Christmas itself has both a religious and broad secular connotation and culture, whereas Three Kings Day is celebrated largely by Christians. In Uruguay, which is a secular country, Three Kings Day is also known as Day of the Child or Día del Niño. El Museo del Barrio noted many of the customs associated with Three Kings Day, which include door-to-day holiday caroling, and the consumption of sweets and group meals are similar to Christmas. Nativity scenes, which are frequently made and displayed by Christians around Christmas, often depict the very moment that the Three Kings Day celebrates, and they feature Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar. As covered by NBC News, the celebration of Three Kings Day in some Latinx households in America may be decreasing. The piece cited a Pew Research Center study that noted the percentage of Latinx people who said their parents brought them cultural celebrations has been fading. According to the New York Times, in Spain and some Latin American countries, Christmas gifts are actually given on Epiphany, and in some places young children pen letters to the Magi in a way that many kids write notes to Santa. In his 2019 address on Epiphany, Pope Francis took the opportunity to connect the two holidays further, instructing people to be charitable, not just toward one another, but toward God as well. Let's just ask ourselves this question. At Christmas, did we bring gifts to Jesus for his party, or did we only exchange gifts among ourselves, he said. If we went to the Lord empty-handed, today we can remedy that. The meaning of the three gifts brought by the three kings has been debated by Christian scholars over the years. The items themselves were gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which, according to the same source, were typical items presented to honor a king or deity in an ancient world. While the worth of gold is obvious, it's believed that there is actually more value to the gifts than previously realized. According to Simon Cotton's account in Chemistry World, the frankincense and myrrh may have especially had significant value beyond just bringing a pleasant odor. He revealed that research has been done on the pain-killing properties of myrrh molecules, and the boswellic acid that's part of the frankincense resin is known to ameliorate issues with both inflammation and arthritis. Frankincense was traditionally burned in temples by the ancient Egyptians, Romans, and Greeks to symbolize prayers rising to the gods. Historically, myrrh was more often used in perfumes and medicines for healing wounds. It's put into mouthwashes and toothpaste to this day. And to preserve bodies, Cotton wrote. According to Ortiz, each item also had a symbolic meaning related to the birth of Jesus. For gold to be presented to Jesus was to signify that he was the King of Kings. Frankincense was used for worship or prayer. And they were there to worship the child Jesus, says Ortiz. And myrrh was used for embalming and in death. Its significance is showing that Jesus Christ will give his life for us. El Museo del Barrio noted that the gold is typically credited to Melchior, the myrrh to Balthazar, and the frankincense from Caspar. Of course, Three Kings Day festivities will be affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. But for those who believe, just like the Magi and their camels traveled all the way to Bethlehem on faith, families will find a way to somehow celebrate this important day. Okay, this next article is called This Woman Turned Her Love for Dancing Around the World into a TV Show. A Hollywood costume designer, a world-traveling sommelier. In this series, we learn about the journeys people take to land the ultimate dream jobs. It all started on a dance floor in the 80s with a 3-year-old in a pink tulle dress. She was the flower girl in 5 weddings that year, which meant too many twirls, jumps, and wiggles to count, but enough to be crowned by aunts and uncles with the nickname Tutto Pepper, or All Pepper in Italian. It's that spice and zest for life that drove Michela Melozzi, now 37, to go from playing with Cabbage Patch dolls to toting Emmy Awards, 4 to be exact, as a globe-trotting dancer. Fast forward to 2020, and Melozzi is the host and executive producer of Bare Feet with Michela Melozzi, a TV series that airs locally on PBS and globally on Amazon Prime. According to Melozzi, the show allows viewers to experience the world one dance at a time. In other words, her job is to travel while immersing herself in dance and diverse local cultures on behalf of her viewers. Did we mention she has the dream job? You might be thinking, what a life. But Melozzi points out that what you see on her TV show is not as easy as a 2-step to create. Nor has her journey been smooth. After Melozzi's infamous toddler year of weddings, her parents, who moved from Italy in the 60s, quickly noticed their daughter's passion and sent her to dance class. Coming from an immigrant family who came to America for a better life, everything my parents saw as opportunity, they wanted me to do, she says. She added that growing up in Connecticut, the youngest of 2 sisters, she was an oddball because of her many extracurriculars, including free flute lessons offered by the city, mixed with ballet, jazz, and tap, all topped off with private violin and piano lessons. And this was long before the pursuit of a smorgasbord of activities outside of school became the norm for many kids. But Melozzi first became attuned to the vastness of the world thanks to her travel agent mother. I used to read through her brochures and see all the planes, she says. It was this amazing little nugget of the outside world that we never got to really see because we were a blue-collar family with parents that worked their butts off to put me and my sister through school. A fruit of that parental labor was Melozzi's graduation from New York University, or NYU, with a degree in music business, which led to a job working as a junior manager and executive assistant to the manager of a heavy metal band. While she appreciated the problem-solving skills that she learned on the job, the accompanying adult babysitting, she described, was not an appealing aspect of the profession. Plus, Melozzi says her body yearned to move as it once did, so she took a literal leap and a pay cut to pursue her first passion and began to work as a full-time dance teacher of ballet, jazz, tap, contemporary, and a Bollywood workout called Masala Bhangra in dance studios and gyms across New York and Stanford. It was during this time period that she came up with the idea for Bare Feet, waking up in the middle of the night with the idea to travel the world and connect with people through dance, an experience she was familiar with thanks to her time in college studying abroad in Florence and Rome, Italy. I found that if I couldn't speak the local language, I was able to use dance and music to connect with people wherever I went, she says. Dance just has this magical way of opening the door. Still, the idea of launching a television show about how dance can connect people around the world, it sounded nice in theory, but Melozzi had no background in television. And this was 2010, before Instagram acquired the reach it has today, or launching a YouTube series was an everyday occurrence. So many people who cared and loved me would say, Michela, that's kind of crazy, she remembers. But she was determined to make her dream a reality. After 5 months of exhausting all of her entertainment industry contacts and pitching her show idea to anyone who would listen, she reached out to NYU friends who studied film and asked if they could help her record a pilot episode. Using her savings, she flew those pals out to Minterno, the southern Italian beach town her parents immigrated to America from, and paid for their expenses for a week while they filmed aspects of Minterno's annual wheat harvest festival. She cut corners by housing everyone at her grandmother's farmhouse and serving homemade meals. There's a photo here of her grandmother holding a giant bowl full of figs. Soon, Malozzi's 30-minute pilot episode was complete, and she began pitching it to third-party production companies, with the hopes that those partnerships could lead to a slot on the Travel Channel. She quickly learned, however, that the Travel Channel had already signed a similar show. Pair that with the fact that she had no rights to her footage for a year due to a deal she had signed with her production company, and it wasn't until 2013 that Malozzi could upload her series herself on YouTube and start to earn some online buzz. But it was an exchange at an American Public Television, APT, conference in Boston that changed her life. I was introduced to a woman who made the programming decisions at a local public media station in NYC where I lived. It was called NYC Life, she remembers. She heard my pitch, took my card, and we parted ways. About 2 months later, I got an email from her saying she wanted to air my show on TV in New York City. Beginning in 2014, for the next 2 years, Malozzi began to film more episodes, working with local tourism boards in each episode's destination to cover the travel cost. Given that her series was airing on public television, as the producer, she was responsible for production cost. And Malozzi says she was not afraid to get creative. Sometimes I would even just film myself and ask someone nearby to hold the camera for me while I was dancing. Each episode of Bare Feet transports the viewer to a new destination, highlighting a dance or genre or music from that location as Malozzi attempts to authentically learn the moves. The audience follows as she meets with a guide or translators who introduce her to dance troupes, chefs, musicians, artisans, and professional dancers, all while the gorgeous landscapes of countries around the world fill the screen. It took 6 years from her pilot episode, but by 2016, season one was complete. Featuring Malozzi waltzing in Vienna, tangoing in Buenos Aires, and chasing adventures in locales like Croatia, Montreal, and Malaysia. NYC was not paying me, but they were giving me free airtime in the number one TV market in the U.S. I knew I could not turn down that opportunity, she says. Malozzi was still working as a dance teacher at the time to support herself. I was scraping every penny to chase my dream, and soon, people were actually watching my show in New York City, and not just my mom. Not only was she quickly racking up viewers, but also awards, including 2 New York Emmy Award nominations and 1 win for Best Host. Her idea for season 2, Bare Feet in NYC, traveling this time across the 5 boroughs, led NYC Media and the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment to co-produce the series for PBS in 2017. Season 3, which was released last October, took a new twist. Following Malozzi's DNA map, traveling to the origins of her bloodlines in Italy, the Iberian Peninsula, Western Europe, Greece, Turkey, the Middle East, North Africa, the Balkans, and Central Europe. Looking back now, she says season 3 looks and feels the closest to how she had envisioned Bare Feet. But in 2019, the concept of pairing travel decisions with her DNA was particularly timely. Last year, heritage travel had exploded to such a trend that even vacation rental company Airbnb and 23andMe, a genetic service provider, teamed up for a partnership to make connecting with your roots, like Malozzi did, even easier. Since season 3 started airing on PBS stations across the country last fall, Malozzi says she's gotten an overwhelmingly positive response, particularly from viewers who have been inspired to travel to destinations on their own DNA map. The show is now also available for free to students with special needs through the described and captioned media program for the visual and hearing impaired, and is shown in classrooms around the country to introduce students to different cultures. It's been a decade since Malozzi first realized her dream job, and she's only now beginning to see the fruits of her labor. but she swears all of the blood, sweat, tears, and money she's poured into her award-winning show have been worth it. Ultimately, Malozzi hopes viewers will walk away from each episode with the realization that we aren't all that different. Especially now, in such a crazy political climate, it's so important to remind people that we're just that. We're just people. All right, this next article is called Kate Middleton and Prince William Meet Real Reindeer on the Latest Stop of Their Royal Train Tour. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge are undertaking a very special pre-Christmas tour aboard the Royal Train. Prince William and Kate Middleton are helping Britain get in the Christmas spirit with their 3-day tour of Scotland, England, and Wales aboard the Royal Train. The Duke and Duchess have already made multiple stops on what will be a 1,250-mile journey, including their most recent stop in Berwick-upon-Tweed, England, where they met some actual reindeer, and some children dressed as reindeer, naturally. Will and Kate met the three reindeer in question, named Chaz, Crackers, and Eccles, if you're wondering. They also greeted a group of children wearing toy antlers. And in a video shared by royal reporter Richard Palmer, Kate can be seen telling the kids, "Thank you for coming to see us." The Duke and Duchess dropped by the school to recognize the work of teachers during the pandemic, both those who enabled children to continue their studies online and those who taught in-person classes for those who needed it. Like the children of essential workers, it's very much in line with the overarching goal of this short tour, which, in addition to spreading holiday cheer, is designed to thank frontline workers and other people who have helped their communities amid the COVID-19 crisis. The trip began on Sunday and will conclude on Tuesday. That has been done across the country throughout this difficult year, and to sharing their gratitude on behalf of the nation for all of those supporting their local communities ahead of the Christmas holidays. If you're looking for a thoughtful gift for the dad who claims he wants nothing, you might think about getting a weighted blanket. You can help your dad sleep smoothly with a weighted blanket. In addition to aiding in restful sleep, studies show that weighted blankets help to alleviate stress and anxiety. Or, if you're feeling generous, you might get him some Apple AirPods Pro. These are pricey at $199. But you will definitely make his life a little easier by replacing those wire-wrapped headphones. And no, they will not fall out of his ears. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.